23. White House Situation Room, Washington, D.C., October 26, 1983, 1:28 p.m. Relief has arrived. Ronald Reagan wears a brand new hearing aid, allowing him to make out the voice on the other end of the transatlantic hotline quite clearly. Margaret Thatcher here. The Prime Minister has excused herself from a parliamentary debate to take Reagan's call. The Iron Lady, just as Reagan's mother, will eventually live out the last dozen years of her life in a state of dementia. But that confusion is 17 years away. Right now, Margaret Thatcher is completely furious. Yesterday, on Reagan's orders, American troops invaded the former British colony of Grenada, an island in the South Caribbean. On October 19th, Marxist commandos overthrew the government, and there are fears that the new Grenadian leaders are aligned with Fidel Castro. The Cuban dictator has long sought to spread communism throughout the Western Hemisphere. Even as Reagan talks with Thatcher, there are civil wars underway in Nicaragua and El Salvador. Under the pretense that the lives of 800 Americans attending medical school in Grenada are at risk, 8,000 American Marines, Navy SEALs, and Army Rangers have invaded the island. Reagan's popularity among U.S. voters is soaring, and the president has bipartisan support in Congress for this bold move. There is evidence that the invasion was planned long in advance of the coup. The overthrown regime was also pro-Cuban. Since 1979, the United States has sought to destabilize Grenada by discouraging U.S. tourism and offering little economic assistance. The Reagan administration escalated tensions by urging the World Bank to block funding to Grenada's government. In August 1981, U.S. troops rehearsed a mock invasion of Grenada on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Unfortunately, Ronald Reagan never informed the Thatcher government. In fact, his advisors told Margaret Thatcher's foreign secretary there would be no attack. That information was then relayed to the British press. In the hours leading up to the American assault, Thatcher attempted to phone the president to warn him against military action, but was told he was unavailable. Ronald Reagan lied to the British, and now Thatcher wants an explanation. "If I were there, Margaret, I'd throw my hat in the door before I came in," the president sheepishly apologizes. Reagan is alluding to an old Irish custom of tossing a cap through a doorway before entering to see if the visitor is welcome. It was later adapted in the American West as the habit of throwing a hat through a doorway to see if it would draw gunfire. "There's no need to do that," Thatcher answers in a calm but firm voice. She knows not to antagonize the American president because there is too much at stake. Soviet President Leonid Brezhnev died almost a year ago, and since that time the Cold War has intensified. The threat level of nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, now led by former Soviet spymaster Yuri Andropov, is at its highest point in 20 years. U.S. nuclear missiles in West Germany are pointed at Moscow, even as Soviet mobile rockets in East Germany are aimed at America's allies in Europe, among them Great Britain. To combat this threat, Thatcher is currently lobbying for American Tomahawk cruise missiles to be based on her island nation. But public opinion in Britain is heavily against such a deployment. Now, at a time when the Reagan-Thatcher relationship needs to be stronger than ever to confront the new Soviet regime, the British are being treated like powerless American vassals. "We very much regret the embarrassment caused you," says Reagan, his voice soothing, a trait learned from his radio years. "We were greatly concerned because of a problem here, and not at your end at all, but here. We have had a nagging problem of a loose source, a leak here. At the same time, we also had immediate surveillance problem, without their knowing it, of what was happening on Cuba to make sure that we could get ahead of them if they were moving, and indeed, they were making some tentative moves. They sent some kind of command personnel into Grenada." "I know about sensitivity," Thatcher responds, alluding to her experience during the Falklands crisis. "The action is underway now, and we hope it will be successful." "We're sure it is. It's going beautifully." "Well, let's hope it's soon over, Ron, and you manage to get a democracy restored," she replies in a cold tone. We think the military part is going to end very shortly. That will be very, very good news. And if we return to democracy, that will be marvelous. As I say, I'm very sorry for any embarrassment that we caused you. It was very kind of you to have rung, Ron. Well, my pleasure. I appreciate it. How is Nancy? Just fine. Good. Give her my love. I shall. I must return to this debate in the House. It is a bit tricky. The debate, in fact, is a wholesale attack on Thatcher by her Labour Party enemies, all because of Grenada. All right. Go get 'em. Eat 'em alive. Goodbye. Ronald Reagan may have succeeded in calming Margaret Thatcher, but new problems continue to emerge all over the world. Even as U.S. forces wrest Grenada from the Marxists, the United States has fallen victim to a new form of warfare. Terrorism. It is 6:22 a.m. on October 23, 1983. This Sunday morning in Beirut, Lebanon, is quiet as the sun rises to the east of the Mediterranean Sea and the nearby Chouf Mountains. American soldiers are just waking up in their four-story barracks at the Beirut International Airport. The 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, are part of a multinational peacekeeping force sent to this former Paris of the Middle East, a once beautiful, cultured city now reduced to rubble after years of fighting. The antagonists are the Lebanese, Israelis, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and an Iranian-backed group known as Hezbollah. The sectarian struggle for power in Lebanon is chaotic and furious. The U.S. Marine unit has a glorious past, having distinguished itself in combat on such famous battlefields as Guadalcanal and Saipan. But today, they are not the aggressors. Outside the barracks, a yellow Mercedes truck approaches the structure nicknamed the Beirut Hilton from a nearby access road. The truck turns into the parking lot in front of the building. At first, the vehicle appears harmless, even as it proceeds to make a single counterclockwise lap around the lot. A 5-foot-high wall of concertina wire separates the truck from the marine compound. Beyond that, a 6-foot wrought iron fence also provides a barrier. Just inside that fence is a sentry shack, surrounded by sandbags, where armed Marines guard the main barracks entrance. 6 months earlier, in the heart of downtown Beirut, an Iranian suicide bomber rammed a delivery truck loaded with explosives into the U.S. Embassy. The blast killed 63 people, among them top intelligence agents. The Marine guards watch the Mercedes. They are expecting a supply truck full of fresh water this morning, so they are not on high alert. Their mission in Beirut is to help stabilize the Lebanese government after years of civil war. Several Christian and Muslim militant factions are fighting for control of Lebanon, and all see the United States as a roadblock to their success. Although the Marines have engaged in several hellish firefights with armed insurgents, some so bad that the Vietnam veterans among them will claim they have never seen fighting so intense, they must maintain the pretense that firing their weapons is a last resort. So under the rules of engagement, the sentries' weapons are unloaded this Sunday morning. In fact, they have to ask permission from their superiors if they wish to employ live ammunition. The circling Mercedes is not, in fact, harmless. Rather, it is packed with the equivalent of 21,000 pounds of dynamite. These are wrapped around butane cylinders to enhance the force of any blast. Suddenly, without warning, the driver guns the Mercedes directly at the rolls of razor-sharp barbed wire at the compound's perimeter. The wire snaps as he blasts on through, aiming for a gate in the wrought iron fence that has been kept open to allow vehicles to move freely. The young soldiers on guard duty frantically try to chamber rounds in their M16s, but the truck is coming too fast. Within seconds, the driver runs through the gate opening, past the sentry box, and toward the barracks lobby. One brave Marine opens fire, while another throws his body in front of the vehicle. To no avail. Then, the martyr, as Iran will one day proclaim this murderer, explodes his ordnance. An enormous fireball engulfs the barracks. A crater 30 feet wide and 40 feet deep marks the site of the detonation. The entire Beirut Hilton collapses. Bodies fly through the air, some landing more than 50 yards from the building. A second suicide bomber strikes the nearby French military compound, killing 58 French paratroopers and 6 civilians. It is an explosion so massive that the FBI will proclaim it to be the biggest non-nuclear bomb in history. The 241 American military killed is the worst single-day toll since the first day of the Tet Offensive, 15 years ago. When rescue workers attempt to evacuate these wounded peacekeepers, terrorist snipers fire at them. The violence in Beirut marks the first full-scale use of terror by Muslim factions against the United States, but it is hardly the last. 2 months later, the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait will be the target of a suicide bomber attack, and 6 months from now, CIA Beirut Station Chief William Buckley will become the fourth of 30 key Americans kidnapped by Muslim extremists in Lebanon. On March 16, 1984, the 55-year-old Buckley rides the elevator from his 10th-floor Beirut apartment down to the parking garage of the Al Manara building. It is minutes before 8 a.m. The career spy lives alone and has just finished a breakfast of coffee and cereal, accompanied by a recording of Dean Martin singing Return to Me. Shackled to his wrist is a locked CIA burn bag containing top-secret documents and sandwiches he has prepared for lunch. One floor down, a well-dressed man carrying a leather briefcase steps into the elevator, then rides wordlessly to the parking garage with Buckley. All at once, the CIA station chief feels a blow to the back of his skull. The assailant's briefcase is filled with rocks, and the American official crumples to the ground. A white Renault containing two men immediately pulls up to the elevator. Buckley is dragged into the back seat of the car, his captors sitting on top of him. The car speeds away in such a hurry that the back door is still open. Within hours, the CIA is aware that the station chief is missing. Soon after, his captors round up his network of spies and informers within Lebanon and murder them one by one. This confirms to the CIA that Buckley was tortured and has broken. But it is not until May 7th, almost 7 weeks later, that American agents see the real horror. An anonymous videotape is delivered to the U.S. Embassy in Athens, showing a naked Buckley being tortured. Ligature marks on his wrists and neck indicate that he has been tied to a rope or chain. Analysts studying the tape note that his body is covered in puncture marks, showing that Buckley has been drugged repeatedly. CIA Director William Casey will later remember of his viewing of the video. "I was close to tears. It was the most obscene thing I had ever witnessed. Bill was barely recognizable as the man I had known for years. They had done more than ruin his body. His eyes made it clear his mind had been played with. It was horrific, medieval, and barbarous." 3 weeks later, another gruesome video arrives. This one is far more graphic than the last. Finally, after 5 more months of torture, a third and final video finds its way to the CIA. Buckley is clearly on the verge of insanity, a drooling mess uttering gibberish and rolling his eyes like a crazy man. But his ordeal is not over. Bill Buckley must still endure almost another year of captivity before he is executed by Hezbollah. Although his Islamic jihadist captors announced the spy's death in 1985, his corpse will not be located until 1991. Buckley was buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors, Section 59, Lot 346. Ronald Reagan was powerless to help Buckley, but he exercised his power by bringing Grenada to its knees. The United States captured Grenada at a cost of 19 American killed and 116 wounded in the 7-week war. Its primary opposition on the island came from a joint Grenadian and Cuban force, which suffered casualties of 70 dead and 417 wounded. They were aided by an additional contingent of Soviet, East German, Bulgarian, North Korean and Libyan troops, which suffered no casualties. And while the tiny island nation may have been an easy target, Muslim extremists are not. However, CIA Station Chief William Buckley does not die without consequence. Reagan will be tormented by his kidnapping and death. The result will be National Security Decision Directive 138, a bold, top-secret decision to counter state-sponsored terrorism by all legal means. Reagan affixes his signature to the directive on April 3, 1984. But legal means will soon be set aside. Iran is currently engaged in a fierce war with its Middle East neighbor, Iraq, and has run out of military weapons. President Ronald Reagan will secretly authorize the sales of weapons to Iran, a sworn U.S. enemy and the nation responsible for killing hundreds of Americans. Reagan knows this, but he decides that liberating the American hostages is worth breaking the law. Under a plan masterminded by Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, American funds will also be secretly funneled to the rebel Contras fighting communism in Nicaragua, whom Reagan admires so much. The scandal became known as Iran-Contra. The administration's actions were illegal for three reasons. The Boland Amendment of 1982 prohibited funding of the Contras beyond congressionally approved limits. The sale of arms to Iran was prohibited, and it is against U.S. national policy to pay ransom for hostages. Some $30 million were transferred from Iran to the Contras. 11 administration officials were ultimately indicted for their role in selling arms to Iran and funneling the money to the Contras, including Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger and CIA Chief William Casey. Nobody went to prison, and George H.W. Bush pardoned many of the perpetrators in the final days of his presidency. Although two key members of the conspiracy, U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and Secretary of Defense Weinberger, made it clear that Reagan knew what was happening, no charges were ever filed against the president. During the 1985 to 1987 investigations, Reagan's personal approval rating dropped from 67 to 46%, but later rebounded. So it is that after 3 years in office, the President of the United States has had many successes. He has turned around the economy, bringing an end to the recession and reducing the level of unemployment. He has countered the Soviet threat in Europe by placing attack cruise missiles in Germany and England, and simultaneously, he has begun urging the Soviets to join him in efforts to reduce the possibility of nuclear war through voluntary arms control. But Ronald Reagan still faces problems all over the world. Despite his best efforts, there is growing tension with the Soviet Union. Reagan has invaded the Caribbean island of Grenada with U.S. troops. He has offended his greatest ally, Margaret Thatcher. And just a few days before that, America absorbed a horrific Muslim terrorist attack in Lebanon. And if all that isn't enough, Ronald Reagan must now begin another exhausting undertaking. Getting re-elected. 24. Rancho de Cielo, Santa Barbara, California, August 1, 1984, noon. Ronald and Nancy Reagan stand before their round leather patio table under a blue California sky, gazing out at the oak-covered hills. Nancy is dressed in a cream plaid sweater vest over white denim pants. The president is even less formal in his blue jeans, boots, and open-necked cowboy shirt. The media form a tight scrum behind a rope line on the gravel car park in front of them, separated from the president and first lady by less than 10 feet. This is a photo opportunity where the press isn't supposed to ask questions. Nevertheless, the president often indulges them with a response should they break protocol, though it is something Nancy and his advisers rarely allow. There is too big a risk he might slip up. Normally, the president's every public movement is stage-managed. He is given a daily set of scripted cards telling him what to say and where to stand for any formal occasion. But today there are no cards, no notes, just the president and the media throwing one-liners back and forth. The time for questions is limited to just 5 minutes. There is very little that can go wrong in such a short period of time. Or so it seems. As distasteful as it might be, Ronald Reagan knows he must talk to the media. This is an election year, and the Republican National Convention in Dallas is just 3 weeks away. After 8 months of pursuing a Rose Garden strategy in which Nancy made sure that Reagan barely campaigned, talking to the media will be a nice little warm-up for the months of hard battle that lie ahead in his quest for re-election. The media have been exceptionally generous to him during his first term, leading editor Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, the newspaper that had brought down Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal, to state, "We've been kinder to President Reagan than any president I can remember since I've been at the Post." This comment is made all the more significant by the fact that not only has Bradley been at the Post off and on since 1948, but he was also drinking buddies with President John F. Kennedy. So Ronald Reagan is not worried about this impromptu news conference. The president is never more relaxed than when here at the ranch. Congress is not in session right now, and he and Nancy are taking advantage of the hiatus by spending 2 full weeks on this 600-acre mountaintop property. Their ranch house is a 100-year-old white Spanish adobe with faux brick linoleum floors that Reagan laid himself. There is nothing lavish about this private retreat. It has the air of a summer camp bunkhouse, yet it restores Reagan's soul unlike any place else on earth. During his time in office, he will spend the equivalent of 1 full year on this mountaintop, looking out over the Pacific. Ronald Reagan works at the ranch, too, but guards his privacy very closely. He spends much of his time in the small living room, a private sanctuary to which not even his closest advisors are allowed regular access. Ever loyal, Reagan has filled the kitchen with GE appliances. The master bedroom is barely big enough to fit the 2 small twin frames pushed together to form 1 bed. The president is too tall for these mattresses, so a padded stool has been positioned at the end. He sleeps with his feet sticking out from under the covers, resting atop the stool. Nevertheless, Ronald Reagan loves the place. Nancy, not so much. One popular legend is making the rounds among the press. Apparently one day, while driving up the long, winding road from the main highway to the ranch, Nancy Reagan was whining non-stop about having to endure another vacation at the remote outpost. She would much rather be back in Los Angeles with her friends. At first, Reagan put up with his wife's complaining, preferring to keep the peace. But this time, he snapped. He ordered his Secret Service driver to stop the limo. Turning to Nancy, he thundered, "Get out of this car!" Shocked, she did. The president then commanded the driver to continue up the 7-mile road. In the rearview mirror, the Secret Service driver could see Nancy standing in the middle of nowhere looking panicked. Finally, the president relented, ordering the driver to turn around to pick her up. But on this afternoon, things are calm. Nancy's dominant protective streak is nowhere to be seen. The president is ready for the 8 questions the press will be permitted this morning. The first queries are softballs. Reagan fields them with ease. Then, ABC newsman Sam Donaldson strikes, posing a question about the Russians. "Is there anything you can do to get them there?" Donaldson asks about a proposed nuclear arms meeting in Vienna, referring to the leaders of the Soviet Union. "What?" Reagan asks, suddenly befuddled. Donaldson smells blood. He has been on the White House beat throughout the Reagan presidency and is no fan of the administration. He was an eyewitness to the assassination attempt, standing just 5 feet from John Hinckley when he pulled the trigger. Still, Donaldson feels little warmth for the president, and many members of the media share his disdain. Donaldson doesn't even bother to speak to Reagan with a tone of civility. He is outwardly antagonistic, often shouting questions. He has publicly insulted Nancy Reagan by comparing her to a venomous snake, calling her a smiling mamba. Sam Donaldson is now in full confrontational mode. "Is there anything you can do to get them to Vienna?" he bellows again. The man who has spent his life speaking on cue, the entertainer who likes to tell a good joke, the politician who has dazzled millions with his rhetoric, has no answer. Ronald Reagan is lost. As journalists and television cameras record the moment, the president seems incapable of rendering an answer to Sam Donaldson. Finally, Nancy Reagan leans over and whispers into her husband's ear, "We're doing everything we can." "We're doing everything we can," the president says to Sam Donaldson. Nancy's words are picked up by microphones from the various network television cameras. 10 days later, while still at the ranch, Reagan himself will mistakenly speak into a live microphone, joking that he has outlawed Russia and that "we begin bombing in 5 minutes." As a result, Soviet military forces will go on war alert in preparation for an attack. With Nancy carefully controlling his every appearance, Ronald Reagan hits the campaign trail for real in September. The nation is riveted by his "Morning in America" commercials, which paint a patriotic picture of a country rising from the shambles Reagan inherited from Jimmy Carter. The president now enjoys a 19-point lead in the polls over Democratic challenger Walter Mondale, the 56-year-old Minnesota native who served as Carter's vice president. At this point, Americans seem comfortable with Reagan as president. Many admire him as a man and a patriot. They like his rock-solid belief in traditional values, and some voters see him as a father figure, putting their complete trust in his perceived paternal benevolence. Yet there is also some unease. Relations between the United States and the Soviet Union are still very tense, and Reagan has exacerbated the situation by publicly calling the Soviet Union an evil empire. Many Americans long for reassurance that their president will avoid nuclear war. They also crave relief from high unemployment and a skyrocketing national deficit that gives their dollar less buying power. Just as important, voters want to believe that their 73-year-old leader is still vibrant. But that reassurance does not come on September 19th, when Reagan visits Hammonton, New Jersey. He wears a dark gray suit and crimson necktie. The small town, famous for its blueberries, has turned out in force to see the president. 30,000 people fill the town square. A large American flag looms over his left shoulder, accompanied by a sign reading, "America, Prouder, Stronger, and Better." Reagan's unlikely speech for today is based on the recent writings of two very prominent conservative voices. The first voice is that of columnist George Will, who behaves decades older than his 43 years. Surprisingly, Will has become a Bruce Springsteen fan. Wearing a bow tie, ears packed in cotton, he watched an entire 4-hour show at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland, as a guest of Springsteen's drummer. Will comes away inspired by the artist's connection to Reagan. In The Boss, as Springsteen is known, Will sees a powerful believer in the American dream. "An evening with Springsteen," Will writes admiringly in the Washington Post on September 13th, "is vivid proof that the work ethic is alive and well." Another guest at that concert is political correspondent Bernard Goldberg of CBS News, who reports that Springsteen's shows are like old-time revivals with the same old-time message. If they work long enough and hard enough like Springsteen himself, they can also make it to the promised land. It is hard to imagine other 1980s pop icons with whom the aging president could identify. The toe-tapping boogie-woogie of his Hollywood days has been replaced by music that makes listeners swing their hips and shake their heads. Young voters listen to musical sensation Michael Jackson, not Frank Sinatra. They like movies such as Ghostbusters and Footloose instead of Reagan's beloved westerns, which hardly get made anymore. So it is only natural that Reagan's campaign staff attempts to make their boss look culturally relevant by cashing in on Springsteen's popularity during this visit to the singer's home state. At George Will's urging, Deputy White House Chief of Staff Michael Deaver has invited Springsteen himself to the campaign event. But the rocker, while having an open date between performances in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, declines. Ronald Reagan invokes Springsteen's name anyway, his speechwriters mistakenly believing that the song "Born in the USA" is a patriotic anthem. In reality, the opposite is true. "America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your hearts," Reagan says to the crowd, It rests in the message of hope in the words of songs so many young Americans admire. New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen. And helping you make those dreams come true is what this job of mine is all about. Chants of USA sweep through the crowd, along with a number of incredulous gasps. Reagan's policies have been savaged on Springsteen's latest album, Born in the USA. Many of its songs vividly depict the loss of homes and jobs for the working poor. The title track, jingoistic in name only, attacks Reagan's economic policies through the eyes of a down-on-his-luck Vietnam vet. At a time when Ronald Reagan wants to appear as if he is in touch, his staff has succeeded in making him look completely clueless by misinterpreting Springsteen's lyrics. Later, the singer himself responds directly. "You see the Reagan re-election ads on TV, you know, it's morning in America," Springsteen tells Rolling Stone magazine, and you say, "Well, it's not morning in Pittsburgh. It's not morning above 125th Street in New York. It's midnight, and like, there's a bad moon rising." Ronald Reagan's aides will later claim that his favorite Bruce Springsteen song is Born to Run, but it's hard for even the most ardent Reagan supporter to imagine this might be true. "If you believe that," Johnny Carson tells America during his Tonight Show monologue one evening, "I've got some tickets to the Mondale Ferraro inaugural ball I'd like to sell you." Geraldine Ferraro is Walter Mondale's running mate. The 49-year-old congresswoman from Queens, New York, is the first female vice presidential candidate from a major party. 3 weeks later, Ronald Reagan is confused when about to deliver his closing remarks in the first presidential debate with Walter Mondale. The location is the Kentucky Center for the Performing Arts in Louisville, and television journalist Barbara Walters is the moderator. Walters has a history with the Reagans. In 1981, she paid a visit to the Reagan Ranch for an interview, gripping her seat in Reagan's four-wheel drive Jeep as he fearlessly drove it up and down the rugged dirt trails. But the 55-year-old Walters is in her element now, pressing the president to begin his closing remarks. However, Reagan believes he is entitled to one more rebuttal to Walter Mondale's statements. Walters is having none of it and firmly tells the president to wrap it up. The night has been a catastrophe for Reagan. Walter Mondale was the aggressor throughout the debate, commanding a quick grasp of domestic policy facts and appearing to be more physically robust than Reagan, despite being 2 inches shorter. "I wanted to show presidential stature," Mondale will later remember. "I wanted to show mastery of the issues. I wanted to show that progressive dimension again. I wanted to show I was more alert than the president without being negative. And I wanted the debate to build around that theme." Mondale senses a mental weakness in Reagan, afterward telling an aide, "That guy is gone." Despite that, Mondale has refrained from attacking the president in a way that would make Reagan look foolish. As Ronald Reagan begins his closing remarks, his rambling, disjointed speech does what Walter Mondale refuses to do. At a time when voters want reassurance of his vitality, the president looks visibly adrift on this very public national stage. Looking into the camera, Reagan begins his soliloquy. "4 years ago, in similar circumstances to this, I asked you, the American people, a question. I asked, are you better off than you were 4 years before?" Already Reagan has lost his place. His eyes do not focus on the front row of the audience as they should. Instead, they roll slowly from side to side as he struggles to recite the closing remarks that his speechwriters have prepared so carefully for this very moment. Reagan continues. "The answer to that, obviously, was no. And as the result, I was elected to this office and promised a new beginning. Now, maybe I'm expected to ask that same question again." To the discomfort of some, Reagan stutters. He appears a far cry from the man who improvised a brilliant speech within minutes of being called to the podium at the 1976 Republican National Convention. He continues, "I'm not going to, because I think that all of you, or not everyone, those people that are in those pockets of poverty and haven't caught up, they couldn't answer the way I would want them to, but I think that most of the people in this country would say, yes, they are better off than they were 4 years ago. The question, I think, says Reagan, again stammering, should be enlarged. Is America better off than it was 4 years ago? And I believe the answer to that has to also be yes. There is little authority in Reagan's closing remarks. Walter Mondale beams. He seemed to lose his place, Leslie Stahl of CBS News will report. He'd lose his thoughts. There were a couple of places where the words he was searching for wouldn't come to mind. His closing statement didn't come together. I flopped, Reagan says to campaign adviser Stu Spencer immediately upon leaving the stage. The president is correct. Polls show Walter Mondale winning the debate in a landslide. 2 mornings later, the Wall Street Journal will publish a story stating that 10% of all people over the age of 75 are senile. Reagan is 73 years old. Even worse, years later, medical studies will link invasive surgeries like the one Reagan endured after the assassination attempt to the eventual onset of memory loss. I didn't feel good about myself, Reagan will confide in his diary during a weekend at Camp David to recover from the debate. The press has been calling him the winner for 2 days now. But Ronald Reagan is not finished. He will have one last chance to convince Americans that he is still fit to be their leader. That chance will come on October 21st in Kansas City. 25. Municipal Auditorium, Kansas City, Missouri, October 21st, 1984, 7 p.m. The man who was nearly murdered 3 years ago is out for blood. Ronald Reagan bounds onto the stage and takes his spot at the lectern, where he stands confident and poised. Despite it being evening, a time of day at which he often fades, the president looks crisp and attentive. As the contest gets underway, Walter Mondale stands on the opposite side of the stage, watching as Reagan fields a series of questions. The president does not like Mondale, thinking him a liar who has unfairly attacked his credibility. For Reagan, this second and last debate is personal. His answers now come easily. There is no sign of the stuttering or stammering from the first debate. There is one question, however, that everyone in the audience knows is coming. Finally, after 20 minutes of debate, Henry Trawitt of the Baltimore Sun gets to the heart of the matter. Is Ronald Reagan too old to be president? Reagan stands ready to answer. After the first debate, Nancy Reagan was livid, eager to apply blame on anyone but her Ronnie. "What have you done to my husband?" she screamed at Deputy Chief of Staff Michael Deaver. They were standing in the presidential suite at the Hyatt Regency in Louisville. "Whatever it was, don't do it again." The problem, Nancy quickly decided, is that the president is being bullied in the pre-debate prep sessions. His advisers, notably Budget Director David Starkman, often interrupt Reagan when he makes a mistake. It is well known in the White House that the troika of Ed Meese, James Baker, and Michael Deaver have a method of slowing down Oval Office meetings if the president does not understand a complex issue. Without insulting him, they diplomatically reframe the discussion until Reagan comprehends. But there is no time for niceties while preparing for a presidential debate. Stockman is only doing his job, feeding the president facts so that he can easily rebut anything Walter Mondale might throw at him. On October 17th, during the initial debate prep for the final confrontation with Mondale, a newcomer observes the scene. From 2:06 to 4:36 in the afternoon, Reagan stands at a mock lectern in the old executive office building, fielding questions and arguing with Stockman, who stands at an opposite lectern playing the part of Walter Mondale. At one point, the normally polite Reagan barks, "Shut up!" at Stockman, filling the room with an embarrassing silence. Tensions are high. Clearly, something must change. Afterward, Reagan returns to the White House, where he meets with the new observer. Roger Ailes is a stocky man with long sideburns. He is part of the so-called Tuesday team, which has prepared the successful Morning in America commercials for Reagan. Ailes also worked for the Nixon administration and is known for his ability to stop chaos cold. Michael Deaver makes the introduction. Roger's here to help you with the debates. What kind of help do I need? Reagan responds. Though it is almost evening, Reagan shows no sign of fatigue other than a slight hand and head tremor. You sort of wandered off the highway in the last debate. I'm going to try and help you focus a little bit, Ailes answers. That's a pretty good idea, the president replies. Roger Ailes agreed with Nancy Reagan that the president's debate problem had nothing to do with age or mental health. Instead, Reagan had been poorly prepared. You're giving him too many facts, too much bullshit that he can't use. You're interrupting him, Ailes tells Deaver. Remember, he's a guy who's used to working with one director, who kind of lays out what the purpose of the thing is, and then he does it. Right now, you've got 5 or 6 or 8 guys interrupting him, all trying to prove they're smarter than he is. So it is that Reagan's debate preparation is altered. Now it is just Ailes and Reagan, one-on-one. The president endures long bouts of pepper sessions in which he has to answer question after question without reaching for obscure facts or numbers. Instead, he simply speaks from the heart. Now, with just 4 days left to the second debate, the strategy seems to be working. The president is upbeat and optimistic. He works hard, rarely seeming to tire. When guys brief people for debates, Ailes will later remember, they want them to memorize what they say because they're the expert. I shifted him back to staying in territory he knew and not trying to memorize a bunch of crap that nobody would remember. Ailes' strategy has revitalized Reagan. I can sum up the day in one sentence, he writes in his diary on Saturday, October 20th, the night before facing Mondale. I've been working my tail off to master the 4-minute closing statement I want to make in the debate tomorrow night. On the same evening, the president and Ailes have a last-minute discussion about the debate. What are you going to say if they ask you if you're too old for this job? Ailes asks Reagan. The two men are standing in a White House hallway, walking to the elevator that will take Reagan back up to the second-floor residence. Michael Deaver, Nancy Reagan, and all of the president's advisers have forbidden any talk about the age issue. But Reagan and Ailes are sure the question will be asked tomorrow night. Reagan stops in his tracks. He blinks and looks hard at Ailes. I have some ideas, the president begins. Reagan tells Ailes what he intends to say. The words are rough and need a rhythm if they are to be effective, but Ailes likes the tone. Once upon a time, Ronald Reagan would have written the line for himself. Even now, he still makes elaborate changes in the margins of the scripts his speechwriters give him, but with his mind filled with debate minutia, Ailes offers to write the entire response for Reagan. Whatever they bring up about age, he tells the president, you go to this answer. You have to hit it specifically. Deliver it the way Bob Hope would. Don't move on the laugh line. If you want to get a drink of water or something and just stare at him, fine. But here's the line. I got it, coach, Reagan responds after hearing Ailes's retort. As the final debate edges closer to a conclusion, the inevitable age question finally arrives. Ronald Reagan is ready. Mr. President, the balding, bespectacled Henry Trewitt says, I want to raise an issue that I think has been lurking out there for 2 or 3 weeks and cast it specifically in national security terms. You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. Reagan is smiling. Trewitt continues, I recall that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances? The president waits a beat, surveying the room. He appears to be fully in command of the situation. I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign, Reagan says casually, allowing the moment to build, taking great care not to rush the punchline. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience. The crowd erupts in laughter. Even Walter Mondale is laughing. Reagan looks down modestly. He knows that even though there are still 45 minutes in the debate, he has already won. 2 weeks later, on November 6th, in a historic landslide, Ronald Reagan is re-elected President of the United States. Reagan wins 49 states. Mondale captures just his home state of Minnesota and the District of Columbia. The final Electoral College tally is 525-13. The next morning, Reagan celebrates the best way he knows how, with a 4-day vacation at the ranch, Nancy in tow. 26. Washington, D.C., Christmas Day, 1986, 6 a.m. The would-be assassin will soon be a free man, but only for today. Escorted by the Secret Service, John Hinckley will spend the holiday at his parents' new home in Northern Virginia. Doctors here at St. Elizabeth's Hospital feel that Hinckley is making significant progress in dealing with his mental illness. They also believe that a day with his family will further the healing process. Jack and Joanne Hinckley have thrown themselves into their son's recovery, selling their Colorado home in order to move east. Each Tuesday afternoon, they attend therapy sessions with their son and a hospital psychiatrist. The Hinckleys are inspired by the advances John seems to be making. It appears that John Hinckley is finding his voice, as his father describes it, even getting elected ward president by his fellow patients. The Hinckleys and the hospital staff, however, are unaware that their son still secretly conceals pictures of Jodie Foster in his room, which is forbidden. Even more disturbing is that John Hinckley is cultivating friendships through the mail with murderers. He has secretly become pen pals with convicted serial killer Ted Bundy, now awaiting electrocution in Florida for murdering 2 Florida State University sorority sisters and a 12-year-old girl. Hinckley is also corresponding with Lynette Squeaky Frome, imprisoned in California for attempting to assassinate Gerald Ford in 1975. Unbeknownst to his doctors or his parents, Hinckley asked Frome to send him the address for the notorious murderer Charles Manson. Frome was a member of the Manson family, members of which brutally murdered 7 people on a 2-day killing spree in 1969. On the second night, pregnant actress Sharon Tate was stabbed 16 times, even as she pleaded to live long enough to give birth. Tate was married to director Roman Polanski, who was not present when the hideous crime took place. Shortly after daybreak, John Hinckley is walked down from his 4th-floor hospital ward by an attendant. He then passes through the locked front doors of St. Elizabeth's and is rendered to his parents. 2 Secret Service agents are in charge of supervising the visit. But it is not his parents with whom Hinckley is eager to spend time. No, it is his girlfriend, 40-year-old Washington socialite Leslie DeVoe. Today will be the first time they have the chance to be alone since they met 4 years ago. Like John Hinckley, Leslie is a cold-blooded criminal. She was sentenced to St. Elizabeth's after murdering her 10-year-old daughter Erin in 1982. In an unconscionable act, DeVoe placed a shotgun against the sleeping child's back and pulled the trigger. She then turned the gun on herself, but it misfired. Instead of killing her, the blast tore off DeVoe's left arm. Like Hinckley, she was declared not guilty by reason of insanity and placed in the mental hospital. At a hospital Halloween party in 1982, Hinckley sidled up to the petite brunette and began flirting. "I'd ask you to dance if I danced," he said. The two spent the rest of the party in deep conversation, sharing their life stories. Leslie DeVoe, who comes from an old Washington, D.C. family, did most of the talking. In vivid detail, she told Hinckley about how she'd murdered her daughter. When it came time for Hinckley to talk about his crime, he showed no remorse. Instead, he led DeVoe to a hospital bulletin board where a newspaper clipping about his evil deed was posted. He was still operating under the delusion it made sense what he did, DeVoe would later remember, that he was supposed to do this to prove his love for Jodie Foster. Although DeVoe knew that Hinckley was still infatuated with the actress, her unlikely relationship with him blossomed. I was lost until I met Leslie, Hinckley will later write. Leslie made me want to live again, and she is the sunshine of my life. Hinckley and DeVoe resided on the same floor, but contact between them was restricted. Still, they found ways around the rules in order to communicate. They ate in the cafeteria at different times, but each furtively taped love letters underneath the dining table for the other to find. On the occasions that they actually saw each other in person, they used sign language to message, "I love you." In time, DeVoe was granted the special privilege of being let outside to wander the hospital grounds. Hinckley, who had no such privilege, would shout to her from a window and she'd answer back. In this way they conversed, not at all concerned that the whole hospital could hear them. A year before, in mid-1985, DeVoe was granted an even greater privilege. Doctors decided she should be released from St. Elizabeth's and be treated on an outpatient basis. Thus, she no longer sees John Hinckley on a daily basis, but returns to the hospital to visit him on weekends where they can talk face to face. They sit across from each other at a glass table on visiting day, holding hands and kissing, ignoring the other patients and their guests all around them. During these visits, DeVoe confides that she is still haunted by the night that she shotgunned her daughter to death. In turn, Hinckley confessed that despite his outward bravado and trademark smirk, he had nightmares about the day he shot Reagan. He went on to tell Leslie that he sometimes dreamed that he was in a wheelchair, like James Brady. In all the hours spent sitting, sharing their feelings, DeVoe and Hinckley have always been supervised. All that will change this morning. As two Secret Service agents stand guard outside, John Hinckley eats Christmas breakfast with his parents and Leslie DeVoe. They then spend two more hours in the living room watching Hinckley home movies. But as the clock strikes noon, the couple steals away. Finding a secluded room, DeVoe takes the initiative, pressing her body against Hinckley's and kissing him passionately. Normally demure, she is surprised and invigorated by her forward behavior. Hinckley is flustered, unsure what to do. He has never had a girlfriend, and his few long-ago sexual experiences were limited to prostitutes. "I think he was startled," DeVoe will later recall. "What is this woman doing to me?" Suddenly, a voice calls out from the kitchen. Jack Hinckley, suspecting what is going on, interrupts the couple, calling them back to the living room for Bible study. By nightfall, a frustrated Hinckley is back in his hospital room alone. It has been an eventful Christmas. If only Jodie Foster had been there to spend it with him. 27. White House Cabinet Room, Washington, D.C., March 2, 1987, 10:58 a.m. Ronald Reagan is being watched very closely. The president sits in his high-backed chair at the center of the mahogany table. His son, Ron Jr., is a guest at today's cabinet meeting, which has put Reagan in a jovial mood. Since their father's being re-elected 3 years ago, the president's children have been cashing in on his fame. Ron Jr. has written articles for Playboy and even appeared in his underwear on Saturday Night Live, but he has always been loyal to his father. This is not the case with Reagan's other children. Daughter Patty has written a book savaging her father and the entire Reagan household, and soon son Michael's painful tell-all is due in stores. Meanwhile, the national press has begun a scathing series of broadsides against Nancy Reagan, blaming her for masterminding the recent firing of White House Chief of Staff Don Regan. It was a battle so vicious and so public that Saturday Night Live lampooned the schism between the First Lady and Regan. All of this has led to growing criticism that the White House is out of control. That is why, in addition to Ron Jr., there are four other special guests at this morning's cabinet meeting. The new Chief of Staff, former Tennessee Senator Howard Baker, no relation to James, is one of those in attendance. He has asked the White House counsel A.B. Culverhouse and Director of Communications Thomas Griscom to observe the President. The final member of the group, 69-year-old Washington insider Jim Cannon is the author of a recent report detailing the inner workings of the White House. Commissioned at Howard Baker's request, Cannon conducted formal interviews with employees throughout the West Wing. He was shocked by what he learned. The battle between Nancy Reagan and Don Regan is just the beginning. Cannon has uncovered evidence that the White House is in chaos at all levels. Ronald Reagan's aides are forging his initials to documents. Cabinet members are ignoring presidential policy to push their own agendas. And down in the White House basement, Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North has spent years illegally selling arms to Iran and then diverting the cash to Contra fighters in Nicaragua. North knew he was breaking the law. But Ronald Reagan is not engaged in many day-to-day White House activities. He delegates much power to Nancy. Occasionally, he avoids the Oval Office altogether, spending hours during the day watching television reruns in the upstairs residence. Even more troubling, it is no longer a given that the president will take the time to read important policy papers. After reporting that information to Baker yesterday, Cannon went on to suggest that Ronald Reagan may no longer be fit to serve as President of the United States. This bold statement is more than mere rhetoric. The 25th Amendment to the Constitution states that if the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting President. But Vice President Bush doesn't know anything about what's going on. Only if the four observers decide that Ronald Reagan is impaired will Bush be told. As radical as this might sound, the 25th Amendment has already been invoked during Reagan's presidency. On July 13, 1985, the president underwent a colonoscopy to remove a precancerous lesion. At 10:32 that morning, he signed a document handing the presidency over to George H.W. Bush. For 8 hours, the vice president ran the country, but ceded power back to Reagan as soon as the president emerged from anesthesia. But now Reagan seems to be in permanent decline. In addition to the colon surgery and his hearing aids, Reagan recently underwent surgery for an enlarged prostate, which forces him to use the restroom frequently. He will soon undergo another procedure to have a cancerous melanoma removed from his nose. The president is now visibly frail, no longer the robust older gentleman who entered the White House 6 years ago. His energy level is lower. He naps frequently. His eyes often have a dull look, and he sometimes has trouble recognizing people that he has known for years. Little does the president know it, but even loyal and uncritical Ron Jr. believes his father is suffering from Alzheimer's disease. So it is that Howard Baker, Jim Cannon, A.B. Culverhouse, and Thomas Griscom sit along one wall, scrutinizing the president's every action. Reagan does not know about Cannon's report, and the cabinet meeting does not seem unusual to him. But it is unusual. If the president shows signs of incoherence, he might not be president much longer. Ronald Reagan's mental and physical woes, however, are not the greatest crisis of his presidency. The real test of his leadership began 4 months earlier on November 3, 1986. An Iranian cleric leaked news that the United States was selling arms to Iran in exchange for the release of American hostages throughout the Middle East. Faced with the embarrassing report, Ronald Reagan appeared live on national television and explained that his administration has sold small amounts of defensive weapons and spare parts to Iran. But the president denied any knowledge of trading arms for hostages. "Those charges are utterly false," he told the massive TV audience. "We did not, repeat, did not trade weapons or anything else for hostages, nor will we." But the people do not believe him. In a poll taken shortly after the appearance, 62% of Americans believe the president is lying. 1 week later, Attorney General Edwin Meese confronted Reagan in the Oval Office. Meese knows that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North and his secretary Fawn Hall have destroyed hundreds of documents connected to the so-called Iran-Contra scandal. In fact, North and Hall shredded so many files that the machine jammed, forcing Hall to smuggle documents out of the office in her boots and panties. But North and Hall were sloppy, overlooking one key memorandum linking the Reagan administration to the illegal arms sale. In hushed tones, Meese informs Reagan of the smoking gun. Hall was later given immunity from prosecution in return for her testimony against Oliver North. Edwin Meese is a Reagan loyalist. Along with Michael Deaver and James Baker, he has advised Reagan on almost every important issue confronting his presidency. Now serving as Attorney General, Meese warned Reagan that he faced impeachment if he did not publicly acknowledge that America sold arms to Iran. Reagan was stunned, but admitted nothing. Instead, he convened a presidential commission to investigate Iran-Contra. Known as the Tower Commission, it was named after its chairman, former Republican Senator John Tower of Texas. The commission completed its three-month investigation in late February 1987. Its 300-page report laid the blame for Iran-Contra on Ronald Reagan, demanding that he take responsibility for the illegality. The report also blamed his staff for shielding him from a number of key issues involving the sale of arms to Iran. "Yes, the president made mistakes," Tower told the press. "I think that's very plain English." Nancy Reagan was livid. She did not blame her husband for the illegal scheme that took place with his permission. She blamed Donald Reagan. The 68-year-old former Marine is a tough Boston Irishman who rose to head the Merrill Lynch investment firm. From there, he became Secretary of the Treasury and eventually White House Chief of Staff. He likened his job to that of a shovel brigade following a parade down Main Street. He said this because he was constantly fighting Nancy Reagan and the messes she created. Nancy's determination to control the president's schedule and her reliance on an astrologer to chart her husband's every move struck him as madness. But she had the president's full backing, so Reagan was powerless to stop her. Early in his White House tenure, Don Reagan discovered just how strong an adversary Nancy Reagan could be when she insisted that he fire Margaret Heckler, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Heckler was one of only two women holding high positions in the Reagan administration. She was a timid person, but Nancy despised her, feeling she was an embarrassment to her husband. Yet neither the First Lady nor the Chief of Staff has the power to fire a cabinet member, especially one who is sitting in a hospital undergoing a hysterectomy. "I want her fired," Nancy told Reagan in a call to his home one night. The president was completing his regular evening workout. This was her favorite time to call Reagan, who got three times as many calls from Nancy as from her husband. Very often, Reagan could hear the sound of the president's rowing machine in the background when he picked up the phone. "But she's recuperating from a hysterectomy," Reagan replied. "I don't care. Fire her." "I can't do it while she's in the hospital." "I don't care. Fire the goddamned woman," Nancy Reagan said, seething. Reagan gave in, and Margaret Heckler suddenly became the ambassador to Ireland, far away from Nancy Reagan. The same fate befell Secretary of Labor Ray Donovan, White House Communications Director Pat Buchanan, and CIA Director William Casey. Nancy insisted that Casey be fired even as he lay in a hospital bed dying of a brain tumor. "He can't do his job," she argued with Reagan, who once again questioned the humanity of the decision. "He's an embarrassment to Ronnie." By January 1987, as the Iran-Contra scandal continued to erode Reagan's credibility, Nancy had taken complete control of the White House. "The president's schedule is the single most potent tool in the White House," Reagan will write, "because it determines what the most powerful man in the world is going to do and when he is going to do it. By humoring Mrs. Reagan, we gave her this tool, or, more accurately, gave it to an unknown woman in San Francisco who believed that the Zodiac controls events and human behavior, and that she could read the secrets of the future in the movement of the planets." Reagan was referring to the astrologist Joan Quigley. Thanks to Nancy's intervention, Ronald Reagan now goes nowhere and does nothing without approval from Miss Quigley. Nancy is also receiving advice from a second stargazer, Gene Dixon, but it is Quigley who has Nancy's ear and who is telling her the president should not appear in public until May because of the malevolent movements of Uranus and Saturn. Donald Regan was appalled. He insisted that the president needed to be seen in public. Hunkering down in the White House at the height of the Iran-Contra fiasco made it look as if he were hiding something. But other than his State of the Union address on January 27, 1987, and some other official business, Ronald Reagan does as Nancy tells him. The president and Reagan actually got along famously, often spending time alone together in the Oval Office telling jokes. This only made Nancy Reagan more determined to edge out the chief of staff. The sniping between her and Don Regan soon seeped out into the public domain. Twice, Regan hung up on Nancy when she called to hector him. Her power continued to grow, and there was growing speculation that the president was dependent and weak. "What is happening at the White House?" New Mexico Democrat William Richardson asked on the floor of the House of Representatives. "Who is in charge?" A constituent of mine asked, "How can the president deal with the Soviets if he cannot settle a dispute between his wife and his chief of staff?" As tensions rose, Nancy becomes so insistent on firing Don Regan that the president ordered her to get off my goddamn back. This, too, seeped into the headlines. "Mrs. Reagan," ABC newsman Sam Donaldson asked Nancy on camera, "did the president ask you to get off his back about Donald Regan?" "No," she replied curtly. Donaldson immediately followed up with a different angle. "Have you been fighting over this?" "No," she insisted. Finally, as Nancy knew he would, Ronald Reagan gave in. "Something has to be done," Ronald Reagan admitted to Nancy, who had already lined up former Tennessee Senator Howard Baker to be Reagan's replacement. The president did not deliver the news to his chief of staff in person. On February 27th, Regan discovered he was out of a job when Nancy issued a statement to cable news outlet CNN. 4 days later, Nancy Reagan gave an address to the American Camp Association in which she viciously mocked Regan. "I don't think most people associate me with leeches," she told the audience of 1800, "but I know how to get them off. I'm an expert at it." Soon the storm passes. As the president's staff likes to say, he has his good days and he has his bad days. Today, March 2, 1987, is a good day for Ronald Reagan. Even though his chief of staff has been fired and the Tower Commission has leveled blame for the Iran-Contra scandal on him, he is in a jovial mood and jokes his way through the cabinet meeting that his son watches. To the four men observing Reagan, he possesses an easy command of facts while telling his usual anecdotes about his Hollywood days. At lunch, the president is even looser, swapping jokes with new chief of staff Howard Baker and looking every bit the most powerful man in the world. Without knowing that he has done so, Ronald Reagan has passed a test. There will be no invoking the 25th Amendment. But another stern trial is just 2 days away.